Today's episode is brought to you by Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, a place to grow, connect, and serve. In-person services are back with some restrictions to help ensure everyone stays safe and healthy. For the latest, visit their website at canbyfoursquare.com.
Welcome to Now Hear This, Canby,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Our first story today is a new chapter for our old library. The Canby City Council will soon consider a proposal to sell the city-owned former library building on Northwest 3rd and Holly Street to Oregon City Brewing Company, which plans to transform it into a brew pub and cidery with a family-friendly arcade, indoor food carts, atrium, and retail spaces. Dubbed the Beer Library, the concept had seemed all but dead last June after councilors had selected the proposal as the one most in line with their vision for the corner property, but rejected OC Brewing's purchase price of $10,000 as a non-starter. That price, offered during a particularly depressed and uncertain time for hospitality-based businesses like OC Brewing due to the pandemic, had indeed been well short of the $950,000 the property was appraised at several years ago. But saying he and his team remained bullish on Canby, OC Brewing Company owner and founder Bryce Morrow had agreed to raise his offer, and the talks had continued throughout last year. On Wednesday, February 3rd, the City Council will consider a proposal to sell the property tomorrow for $500,000. The city will also maintain a $100,000 promissory note on the property, which will come due if the new owners do not complete at least $1 million in upgrades. The work required to renovate the aging building and realize Morrow's ambitious vision for the beer library is substantial. According to the city, OC Brewing had originally anticipated improvements at $1.5 million, later revising those estimates to be as high as $2.3 million. The brew pub would feature three permanent indoor food carts offering a diverse array of cuisines, on-site brewing including the company's burgeoning barrel aging and blending operations, and an arcade which would be open to all ages until late in the evening. The developers would drastically transform the existing space, including peeling back a portion of the roof to create an outdoor courtyard in the heart of the project. They would also retain two other retail spaces they would seek to lease out to complementary businesses. In short, the Beer Library would be a multi-use, family-friendly brewery that aims to be a living room for the community. Reached Wednesday evening, Morrow confirmed to Now Hear This, Canby, that the project was moving ahead largely according to designs that were first submitted to the city in April 2020. As you know, it's been kind of a long, drawn-out journey to get here, he said. But it's just like anything. If at first you don't succeed, try again. Many hurdles remain, not the least of which is the city council actually signing off on the purchase next week, but Morrow appeared ready to hit the ground running. He said he hopes to have a bulk of the construction completed by April of 2022. We're really excited for us and for downtown Canby, he said. We think it's a great location across from the park. You know, it really is the heart of Canby, and we think it's going to be a really great thing for the community to have that building activated. An Oregon man is facing multiple charges, including second-degree murder, after police said he struck as many as 10 people, killing one, in a deadly motor vehicle rampage through several Portland city blocks on Monday. Paul Rivas, 64, was identified by the Portland Police Bureau late Tuesday night, Lodged at the Multnomah County Detention Center, he faces charges of second-degree murder, 6 counts of 6th-second-degree assault, and 7 counts of failure to perform the duties of a driver. More charges will be considered by the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, police have said. Investigators said Rivas was driving erratically through a 15-block area of southeast Portland Monday afternoon when he struck several pedestrians and at least 2 cyclists. One woman, later identified as Jean Garich, 77, of Portland, was killed and 9 others were injured in the incident. Witnesses at the scene told the Oregonian the driver struck Garich, then turned around and hit her again, dragging her a short distance. Medical examiners ruled that Garich suffered blunt force trauma and listed the death as a homicide, police said. Family members paid tribute to Garich in a statement released Tuesday night. Jean Garich was not a nameless victim, family members said in a statement released to the police and media outlets. She was a loving mother of 2. She was a proud grandmother of 5, ages 4 to 16. She would have turned 78 in 12 days. She beat cancer 5 years ago. She received her first COVID-19 vaccination shot last week and was overjoyed to get out in the world again. She has lived in the city of Portland since 1972, and for those 48 years, she has loved her community of friends, Forest Park, and the proximity to nature. The family went on to thank the Good Samaritans who were at the scene and asked for privacy. Immediately following the incident, authorities took Rivas to a nearby hospital for treatment before booking him to jail. Police said detectives did not find evidence that the incident had been an act of terrorism or politically motivated. A sample of Rivas's blood was drawn and has been sent to a lab for analysis. Canby South, a nearly 700,000 square foot e-commerce warehouse being developed in the South Canby Industrial Park, is expected to bring significant truck traffic as well as good paying jobs and other economic investment, developers said at a neighborhood meeting earlier this month. The massive new industrial development is being considered at a 47.5-acre property owned by the Wygand family and located on Township Sequoia and Molino Roads. The property is currently a fescue grass seed field and is zoned for light industrial use. The project's developers are proposing a single mammoth warehouse building designed for e-commerce use and spanning 683,000 square feet, or approximately 150,000 more than the Columbia Distributing's new beverage warehouse and distribution facility located further up Molino Road. The project's team includes developer Trammell Crow Company, one of the most active industrial developers in the Portland metro region, and architects VMLK Engineering and Design. Representatives of both firms led the neighborhood meeting, which was done virtually, and which Now Hear This Canby was permitted to attend. TCC Principal Steve Sieber, who had also helped shepherd Columbia Distributing through the Canby planning process when it was still known by the codename Project Shakespeare, has taken the lead on Canby South. Though Canby South does not yet have a confirmed tenant, the project has been described as an e-commerce because that has been the general direction of most industries in recent years, particularly in the wake of COVID-19. Whereas Columbia Distributing was designed with its end user in mind, Sieber revealed TCC has engaged with at least 4 possible users, one of which is expected to eventually occupy the property. Think of it as a high-stakes, super-secret version of The Bachelor, except that instead of getting a rose and a ring at the end, you get 700,000 square feet of industrial space. Though Sieber was unable to name any of the companies interested in the project, he did say 2 prospects have shown interest are food manufacturing related, and that he believes Canby's reputation as a community closely linked to its agrarian roots was one of the things that appealed to them. One of the companies makes food packaging, Sieber said. Those are the types that like to be out here because they can have a pseudo-agricultural association, he said. It feels a little more rural. The livability of Canby is a major attraction for large employers, Sieber noted. Though it's impossible to be more specific without having a final end user in mind, Canby South is designed to accommodate 2 shifts of approximately 300 employees each. The ability to attract employees is a huge draw for your area, Sieber said. You look at Columbia Distributing, that's one of the big things that attracted them here. The utilities and other costs in the industrial park are very good compared to some of the other places in the Portland metro area. Of course, with all those jobs comes lots of traffic. This site will have a tremendous amount of traffic associated with it, both autos and truck trailers, with the nature of the industrial users that we see today, Siever said. We have compared it to Columbia Distributing in that regard. We do think it's going to be very similar. Neighboring property owners who took place in the meeting expressed deep reservations about the impact the project would have on their quality of life in terms of noise, lighting, and adding hundreds of trucks and other vehicles onto roads already struggling to handle their current traffic loads. Who would want to live across from this? Asked a resident who lives on the street on Township, which is expected to be the property's main ingress and egress. It sounds like the light pollution and traffic are going to be a nightmare. We moved here from Sherwood a couple of years ago to escape all the development, her husband agreed. I guess we moved to the wrong place. Siebert said developers would begin construction by the fall of 2021, though that will depend on the city's approval process. He anticipated construction would take 15 to 18 months, and the prospects they have engaged with are all targeting occupancy dates in early 2023. A new outbreak of the novel coronavirus at Marquis Hope Village has grown to 40 cases and 4 deaths as of last week, according to the Oregon Health Authority. A public relations agency representing Marquis told Now Here This Canby those numbers include 25 residents and 12 staff members, with the remainder being close contacts whose cases have otherwise been linked to the facility, typically family members or housemates of employees. The most cases, 21 residents and 7 staff, have been linked to Marquis Post-Acute Rehab, which is the same facility that had become the site of one of the state's largest and deadliest outbreaks last June, with 113 total cases and 18 deaths. This outbreak was considered resolved by the end of July. In this newer outbreak, which started 7 months later in November, an additional 4 residents and 4 employees in the adjacent assisted living facility have contracted the coronavirus, while a single staff member of the new memory care facility has also tested positive. The representative, Jenna Cooper, told Now Here This Canby that staff members who test positive for the coronavirus must quarantine at home until they clear COVID-19 protocols. Residents who test positive are temporarily moved to a separate coronavirus treatment facility for care. Though this outbreak has been active for more than 2 months, new cases continue to be reported, including an additional 4 that were discovered between the week ending January 10th and the one ending January 17th. Cooper said Tuesday that all the residents who tested positive were now considered recovered, suggesting that 4 newer cases were staff or close contacts linked to the outbreak. The majority of residents, 85%, and staff, 65%, at the Canby facility had received both doses of COVID-19 vaccine as of January 14th, but it does not provide instant immunity. In fact, scientists say it takes 7 to 14 days after receiving the second dose to develop full immunity. A woman and a dog were killed, and another woman was injured, following a crash near Carver in rural Clackamas County on Monday. Clackamas County Sheriff deputies responded to a 2-vehicle crash in the 15,200 block of South Springwater Road. They were told both drivers were injured and trapped inside their vehicles. When emergency crews arrived, they found a red Toyota Celica and a blue Volvo C30 with extensive front-end damage, authorities said. Crews went to work to free the involved drivers, and a life flight was called. The driver of the Toyota Celica, Veronica Lynn Ziering, 52, of Portland, sustained critical injuries. She was taken to a local level 1 trauma hospital via life flight, where she later died. Ziering's family has been notified, officers said. Authorities determined Ziering was the at-fault driver in the crash. Based on witness statements and other evidence collected at the scene, authorities believe that Ziering abruptly crossed the center line and collided with the Volvo C30. Analysis of her blood did not reveal alcohol, but confirmed the presence of a depressant and stimulants, to include methamphetamine, authorities said. The presence of these substances do not necessarily indicate impairment, authorities cautioned. Rennie, a 14-year-old cockapoo, died due to injuries sustained from the collision. Ziering's license was suspended, and she also had a history of driving without insurance and a suspended license, according to police. The driver of the Volvo C30, a 62-year-old Happy Valley woman, was traveling with her dog, Rennie, and also taken to a level 1 trauma unit. She sustained fractures and abrasions in the crash. Rennie, a 14-year-old cockapoo, died due to injuries. The investigation is ongoing. The Clackamas County Sheriff's Office said this was one of 20 traffic collisions that Clackamas County 911 operators dispatched emergency personnel to throughout the day on Monday.
Stay connected to what matters most this winter with unlimited high-speed internet from DirectLink. While things may look a little different this year, as we all work together to keep everyone as safe and healthy as possible, you can be confident that DirectLink's reliable network will keep your video calls, Snapchats, stories, and photos crystal clear and at your fingertips whenever you need them. In 2021, DirectLink is thankful for all of their amazing members and is proud to be your local internet, video, and voice provider for over 116 years. Okay, on the Cammy Conversation today, we're going to be revisiting one of my favorite episodes from the distant, distant past. We're going to be talking about the Mark Prairie Schoolhouse and some of the history of that building and really that settlement and that family. We have on today, welcoming back to talk to us again about this, is one of the members of that family and also the current president of the Mark Prairie Historical Society, Judy Oss. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Tyler. It's good to be with you again.
Absolutely. That's always a relative term nowadays, right? We are talking via Zoom, but it's very good to see your face live and in color. How you been holding up?
Well, pretty well. I'm kind of like the school kids. I need that social interaction. So.
Yeah. We all need that, don't we? This is hard.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's start, Judy, by talking just a little bit, maybe reminding folks about some of the wonderful history of the Mark Prairie family and the schoolhouse. The Mark Prairie family was led by a guy named John Mark, came out here from Missouri with him and his wife and six children. And at that time, two grandchildren on the Oregon Trail in 1846-47. Is that right?
I believe so. I don't have that history right in front of me, but yes, it was about that time.
Yeah. Settled in the area south of Canby. The John Mark and his wife started a farm about 640 acres, and some of the sons kind of branched off and did their own farms of several hundred acres. Like so many of the pioneer stories, they turned into a town, which they inevitably named after themselves. It became known as Mark Prairie. And I believe from studying my some of the history on my own, that it was their eldest son, Alexander, who was a big proponent of education. And he was the driving force between starting the school.
Yes, that's right. They had a school on the property for a while. And that was a log cabin. And then as time went on, they felt like they needed to help educate the children in the community. So that's when the 2 acres was donated and they built a school on it, and it later became part of the Canby School District. But there was not actually a town there.
Right.
It was just the schoolhouse was
right.
The only facility.
Right. Yeah. It was all kind of based around this family. But what I thought was so cool is that, you know, Alexander, being that proponent of education, he obviously was driven by wanting his kids to be able to get a good education, but opened it up to all the neighboring children and whatnot, and kind of invited all the kids from all the neighboring families and farms. And I think that's a really cool picture for our area, our local history around here. So, as you said, I believe it was in about the 1940s that the Mark Prairie School District, at that time, I believe with about a dozen other districts, all joined up with Canby School District. And at that point, the one room schoolhouse ceased to actually operate as a school. And you might know a little bit more of this history, Judy, having been involved in it, but remained sort of a cultural center. I think it might have been used for church services, plays and things like that. Is that right? It was still used.
Yes, in 1947 was when the Camby School District closed down the school and the students were brought into the Camby schools at the time. It was what we called the Camby Castle. Camby community is familiar with that. But then they deeded the property over to the community, and it was originally called the Mark Prairie Community Club. And that's where we all gathered for monthly meetings and activities like reunions and baby showers, bridal showers, Christmas parties. It was a big social spot, highlight for the community.
And for a long time, I'd love to hear if it's still going. I know when we talked a couple years ago, it was the annual family reunions that would happen in July each year, that in my research started back in the 20s.
Yes, it's been, I think, about 120 years now. Wow. That the Mark families had the reunion, and they've only missed like three different years of having a reunion, and this past year was one of them, but they didn't give in. They had a reunion via Zoom, and it turned out we actually had more people joining us via Zoom than we did at the previous reunion.
That's amazing. What was that like?
Well, it was fun because we had people from Canada and Southern California and Washington, Oregon, from all over. So we were able to include all the Canadians that are actually part of the family.
Wow. So, that's amazing. Yeah. Did you guys just spend the first hour talking about how crazy everything was with the pandemic? That was back in July. That was still fairly early days, and things were just like, this is so weird.
Yeah, we did. And it was good to catch up with the different family members. And we spent about a half hour then with a meeting so that we could catch them all up on the progress that we were making at the schoolhouse and the grounds.
Right. The hardest logistical part of all that, if I understand, was having to mail the individual servings of potato salad and whatnot to all the different, because it's normally a potluck, right? Isn't that how you normally do it?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's how it's normally done.
Cool. Well, that's so neat that you were able to keep that alive in that way. And maybe in this coming year, hopefully when things get a little bit back to normal, maybe you can still, as I know a lot of places are talking about, still kind of incorporate some of those elements to where folks that can't make the trip could still join in, because that's one maybe silver lining of this pandemic that I think a lot of people have seen is that although it's still preferred to meet in person, sometimes it's not possible, and to still be able to have some kind of connection when those things aren't possible, it's great to be able to do that.
It sure is. Yeah. And it was especially nice to see all the members of the Mark family that live in Canada.
Yeah.
So some of them come down for the reunion, but some of them are unable to. So that was a real blessing.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if, Judy, are there any parts of the family that still have the name Mark?
Yes.
Cool.
Not too many, especially the local Mark, like Vesta Mark, that was very well known in our community.
All of my research is from Vesta's writings. Yeah.
Yes. And they were all females. So no one left from that family. Her grandson, they married Bizons, which also was part of the Meridian school. and they live just over on Meridian Road, but they carry the name Bizance, even though they are a Mark family.
Yeah. Judy, I know for my family, and I think a lot of other people, I hear about you guys still preserving, you know, your history and your family going back hundreds of years at this point, and that still being so important to you. And for many of us, it's not unfortunately like that. You know, we might have ancestry.com or whatnot and, you know, get curious and try to figure out what we can. But a lot of those connections are not there as easily as they are for you, even though I know that there's challenges even for you guys. But I'd love to just ask you what you have found as valuable about being able to keep those family connections alive and that personal family history so strong for you.
The value in it is being able to preserve this for our future generations, and especially the work we're doing at the schoolhouse.
Yeah.
The school is basically in pretty good condition, but it does need a lot of maintenance.
Yeah.
Because the maintenance hasn't been kept up too well in probably the last 10, 15 years. We have found some historical documents there, which we found just recently a drawer full of old maps that they used in the schoolhouse. And I contacted one of the former students, and she said, yes, she remembered those maps as being used. They're all in rolls.
For like world maps, country maps?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought you were talking like treasure maps or I watched too many movies, Judy.
Yeah, they were treasure maps. It was a treasure to us to find them. Mm. We thought it was just an old podium.
Right.
And we got to trying to open it or pull the lid up on it. And when we finally got it open, found out it was world maps and county maps.
I remember when we did this interview with you and Peggy out at the schoolhouse back in, I guess it was 2019. We unfurled that huge, like wall-sized thing that I think we decided must have been from a fair or something, but it had all of these sponsors, or maybe it was FFA. I don't know if you remember, but all these sponsors from like 50 years ago, some places that are still around, some that aren't. But it was just such a neat historical artifact to see that still preserved. And so I'm not surprised. I feel like anything you find that's rolled up in the My Prairie Schoolhouse, you should unroll it, except maybe toilet paper, but anything else is going to be a good find, I feel like.
Yeah, and we found some old school books and records from that go clear back to the 50s. So we have found some valuable things that helps for preserving our history.
Wow, that's great. So I'd love to wrap up, Judy, with you just telling us a little bit about the where we're at now with the more recent efforts to preserve that history, preserve the school. I believe that at least at one point when we were talking, there were attempts to bring it back as a 501c3 and start doing some fundraising and donation. Not sure how the pandemic has impacted that, but I know that the local history is important to a lot of people, and you guys have something special there, and I'm sure a lot of people would like to support it if they can. So,
well, we did get our tax exemption back. We are a 501c3. We're welcoming anybody that wants to join and help us with projects and funding. We've been working on getting grants for the maintenance of the schoolhouse. And some of our recent projects, we've had the roof cleaned and the fireplaces checked out for the safety of the schoolhouse. And our biggest project, probably after getting our tax exemption, is setting to work and getting a strategic plan for for the next 3 to 5 years what we really want to do. And we're just about complete with that. And we've also been working on the a preservation plan. We worked with a couple of community people, plus one of the family members that restores historic homes, worked with them in order to come up with our preservation plan. So we've completed some of those items already, but it's going to take a lot to bring it back because we need to repaint the exterior. The paint is just peeling on that, and in order to really preserve it, we need to get that done. But we need the funds for it, and because of the way the pandemic has kind of slowed things down right now, we haven't been able to have any fundraisers. So that's hopefully coming up in the very near future that we can plan some. But that's where we're going, and we're trying to kind of restore the trees that are, or preserve the trees, I should say. We're having a couple of badly diseased ones removed within the next month. And this is for the safety of the people that use the grounds, as well as we don't want it to fall on the schoolhouse, the tree that's so badly diseased.
Right, right, right. That would just set you back even more on the fundraising. That's nobody wants that.
Sure would.
I'm sure people would be curious, is the schoolhouse ever open for visitors or the grounds? Can people drive by and just look at it, or how does that work?
Well, they can drive by now and look at it, but we do keep the gate padlocked because we have had some vandalism on our mailbox and some other attempts, so we had to lock the gate there because it is out in the country. But we've had 3, I believe, open houses, and we plan to have many more and hopefully get some activities in there. Like, we used to have 4-H and scouting in there, but since they haven't been able to meet like they used to either, we haven't had them recently, but we're hoping to get them back in there, and also community meetings. If anybody needs a meeting place, we would want them to contact us. But Soon as we get through this pandemic and things are opened up, you just expect to see more of us.
That's awesome. That's great to hear. So correct me if I'm wrong, Judy, you guys do have a Facebook page, Mark Prairie Historical Society, and a website, which is markprairiehistoricalsociety.org, all one word. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. Cool. Well, check that out if you're interested in learning more. It's actually a great website. I'm on it now. You can learn more about that, about the society and the history of the Mark Prairie Schoolhouse and how you can help. Judy, thank you so much for taking time out to talk to us today. Again, it's very good to see you, and wish you well. Take care.
Thank you, Tyler. Appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with 3 realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. Mm-hmm. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was going to go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate, and we got in a carriage ride with the horse, and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people, you're really up in their business for a period of time. And sometimes it's a couple months, sometimes it's a couple years, sometimes it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Mm-hmm. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me.
Yeah.
3 generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life. Mm-hmm.
How can people find you?
How can they not, really? we have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
All right, friends, we are going to draw this episode towards a close with another edition of Can Be Then. And this segment sponsor, we are proud to partner with The Book Nook, Canby's amazing local bookstore and gift shop. I think that books are the most important thing, and I am so excited to be partnering with The Book Nook. It is your source for new and used books, comic books, audiobooks, vintage books, toys, gifts, games, you get the idea. It's all things books across from the backstop in downtown Canby. Now, on Canby Then today, we will be heading just south of town to tell you the story of one of the last remaining one-room schoolhouses that is still standing today, known as Mark Prairie. Much of our Canby's history can be traced back to the times of pioneers, covered wagons, and the Oregon Trail. So it is not surprising to discover that the Mark Memorial Park and Mark Prairie Schoolhouse south of Canby share these origins as well. Both the park and the school, as well as the road they are located on, are named for the family of pioneer John Mark. John was born in Philadelphia on January 11, 1795, the son of an Irish weaver. When he was still a child, his family relocated to Lee County, Virginia, where he later joined the Virginia militia before being inducted into the U.S. Army. In January 1815, John fought in the Battle of New Orleans, one of the last and largest battles in the War of 1812. After the war, he returned to Virginia, where he married his childhood sweetheart, Martha Frances, we call her Fanny, Forrester, in July of 1818. After the death of his mother, John moved his family to Harlan, Kentucky, and then in 1838, they moved again to Missouri. It would seem that John wasn't satisfied with staying somewhere for very long. In the spring of 1847, he and his family left Jackson County, Missouri, on a covered wagon, headed for the Oregon Trail. They arrived in Oregon City on October 12th of that year via the new Barlow Trail. The family consisted of John, who was 52 at the time, his wife Fanny, 2 sons, 4 daughters, and 2 grandchildren. Their eldest daughter, Mary Ann, and her husband, Jacob Adams, had braved the trip with their 2 smallest children, Harrison, age 6, and Margaret Elmira, age 5. John and Fanny's other married daughter, Elizabeth, lost her husband on the journey. They had no children. Upon their arrival in Oregon, John traded a yoke of oxen and a wagon, or a mare, depending on who you ask, for 640 acres of land with a cabin located south of the Molalla River. His eldest son, Alexander, settled 320 acres south of his father's farm, and Jacob and Marianne selected 640 acres further south, adjoining Alexander's land. With the Mark family owning such a large portion of the new territory, a settlement of sorts was slowly taking shape, and the name Mark's Prairie was taking hold. Alexander built a southern-style home on his land, probably in remembrance of the family home in Virginia. On February 21, 1854, he married Sarah Jane Jordan, who had crossed the plains with friends in another train. Death claimed Sarah Jane within 5 years of marriage, leaving 3 little children for Alexander to care for. He managed to do so with the assistance of his sister, Luvina Shirley, who by this time had 4 children of her own. 12 years later, Alexander married a widow, Mary Susan Sparks, who had 3 children of their own. The couple eventually had 3 more children, bringing the total to 9. As a strong believer in education, Alexander provided tutors for his children and others in his home. Later, he built a log schoolhouse for all the neighboring children to attend as well. Tragically, though, the building was destroyed after only a few years. After the Marks Prairie School District boundaries were established by county officials in May of 1879, Alexander and his wife again demonstrated their commitment to ensuring the education of local children by giving 2 acres of land to the district to be used for school purposes. The district was to build the schoolhouse and maintain the road. According to the original deed, when it ceased to be used for 2 consecutive years, the track would revert to their designated heirs. The lumber for the school building was hauled from Cole's Sawmill on the south bank of the Lumalala River, probably near the old river crossing and what is now Goods Bridge. The original building is still standing and, in fact, has been changed very little over the years. The oldest county school records date back to February of 1900, when T.A. Kampau began teaching 50 pupils for a term of 3 weeks at $35 per month. The next teacher, Charles A. Meischer, also received $35 per month for a term of 12 weeks with 59 pupils enrolled. The majority of teachers were ladies with terms of 3 weeks to 5 months, and in the first 4 recorded years of the school, a total of 8 instructors taught there. In 1904, the first 8-month school year was introduced. Salaries averaged $55 per month until 1919, when the district shelled out the handsome amount of $125. The number of children attending varied from 62 to 39 in later years, with all 8 grades in 1 room. The teacher boarded with a local family in the community and often did his or her own janitorial work. When the Marks Prairie School District joined with the Canby District in 1946, the building and the grounds ceased to be used as a school. Rather than reclaim the property, the Mark heirs deeded the property to the Marks Prairie Community Club, an organization which had been formed to manage the property, but it's no longer active. In 1948, the remains of the Mark Pioneers were relocated to the site, using the tombstone from the original Mark Cemetery for the monument. The property was then named Mark Memorial Park by county officials. The woodshed was moved to the rear sometime around 1949 and transformed into a kitchen. Since that time, the school site has served the needs of the community in providing a meeting place for family reunions, wedding receptions, parties, picnics, church groups, 4-H clubs, Mother's Club, Extension Club, and monthly meetings of the community club. In 1979, the community club celebrated the 100th birthday of the district with a picnic held at the park. More than 100 attendees signed the guest book, and it was a wonderful day of visiting and meeting new friends. Unfortunately, the school bell could not be rung, as it had been stolen. A major restoration was undertaken in 1993, and a concrete foundation was placed under the building to strengthen and straighten it. A well was drilled 5 years later, and a new cedar shingle roof was installed on the main building. The bell, it was also replaced. In 2010, the community club changed its name to Mark Prairie Historical Society and obtained 501c3 status. Today, the building remains in good condition and is often used for community meetings or by various religious groups. Half of the east wall is lined with framed 4-H club achievement certificates. Every year since 1925, the descendants of John Mark have returned to the old schoolhouse for a family reunion and picnic on the 4th Sunday of July. In nearly a century, this event has been missed only 3 times, including 2020 for obvious reasons. However, the family still met via Zoom, which actually allowed more relatives to join since they didn't have to make the drive. All right, folks, well, I hope you enjoyed that episode of Canby Then, brought to you by Canby's own The Book Nook. And as we draw this episode towards a close, please have a great day.
Hey, Frankie, you okay? You seem kind of down.
Yeah, just bummed. Miss going to the Wild Hare. I know you can still get takeout and all, but it's just not the same.
You know they're open again, right?
What?
Yeah, they've been open for a while now. Don't you cover, like, the news?
Hey, I'm only human, okay?
Okay. Well, I can tell you that the Wild Hare and their amazing staff are thrilled to be open again for delicious meals and fun times. They are strictly following all the recommended safety guidelines, and they have the only covered outdoor patio in Canby, with lots of tables spaced 6 feet apart and umbrellas also spaced 6 feet apart, and fantastic ambiance. And hey, if you're still more comfortable with carryout, they can hook you up there too. Find their menu and other information online at thewildhairsaloon.net or check them out in Canby in Oregon City. Anything to add, Frankie? Frankie? Oh, I guess he left. God, he must have been really hungry. Now Hear This Canby is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website, olivia13.com.
Now Hear This Canby is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.